There was the debate. Yes, lots of economy there, and we will do some of that. The big story, though, is what a softball game can tell us about American manufacturing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 27th of September. Glad you could be with us, everybody. To quickly review the economic events of last night at Hofstra University, they went roughly in this order like this. Jobs, China, Mexico, global trade, taxes, Mexico again, NAFTA, jobs again, taxes again, more NAFTA, debt, more jobs, and so on. Coming up in about 3 minutes, the state of manufacturing in America today, where those jobs used to be and where they are going. Dateline is going to be Rochester, New York. First, though, to the debate last night. It's a tired old phrase I'm about to use, so apologies in advance, but it does resonate. Follow the money, like the actual money, because as the two candidates started talking, currency traders started paying very close attention, a trait that makes foreign exchange markets good indicators of what people think is going to happen, the expectations game, because there is real money on the line. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Juan Carlos Alderete watched the presidential debate last night from Mexico City.
Yeah, of course. We were very focused on what was happening.
He's a currency strategist at Banorte, the third largest public bank in Mexico. He cares because a lot of Donald Trump's policy proposals would have a negative effect on Mexico's economy.
We have been receiving several calls today about what this could mean going forward, not only for the Mexican peso, but also to other local investments.
And lo and behold, the Mexican peso traded higher today, up 2.1% after falling against the dollar for months.
Hillary Clinton was the clear winner.
Financial markets, stocks, also had something to say about the debate. Sam Stovall with S&P Global Market Intelligence.
Equity markets rose in price after the debates. The market viewed the outcome of the debate to be favorable toward the Clinton camp.
That's because in this case, markets associate Clinton, who's with the incumbent party, with stability, according to Paul Christopher, global market strategist for Wells Fargo Investment Institute.
There is a history of the stock market as early as August of election year predicting the outcome.
If the S&P goes up between August and November, it's a sign the incumbent party will win. It's right 82% of the time, according to S&P's Stovall. But financial markets have a limit to their predictive power, says David Rothschild with PredictWise.
You have to realize they have to worry about a lot more things than just the election. It is a noisier indicator.
Which is why he really likes betting markets set up specifically for an election, where people basically make bets and draw in all kinds of information from get-out-the-vote funding to debate performances. PredictWise gives Clinton a 75% chance at winning. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Couple other quick things before we move on. The Wall Street Journal is reporting today that the board of directors at Wells Fargo is considering clawing back some of CEO John Stumpf's paycheck. Stumpf, as you might remember, spent a few unpleasant hours in front of the Senate Banking Committee last week answering questions about all those fake accounts that the company opened up on behalf of unsuspecting customers. Cross-selling is the term of art there. Elsewhere in Washington-related news, the Senate of the United States couldn't get past the 60-vote threshold that's become the norm for getting anything done in that chamber. The anything in this case is a stopgap spending bill to keep the government funded past Friday, which is when the current authorization runs out. All of that said, you heard it here first, gang. Actual chances of a government shutdown 40-something days before a presidential election? Vanishingly small. Wall Street today, yeah, it's all good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A couple of weeks ago, on a balmy Wednesday night, I was at Ridgewood Park in upstate New York. Chuck Steffen was at the plate.
Come on, Chuck.
You've probably never heard of him, but he is one of the greats. I know this because Joe Gogolski is one, too, and he told me.
You've got four of the all-world players here. You've got Steffen, who's the most valuable player of defense, all-world. Pete was all-world. Dean was all-world, and I was all-world. So you've got four out of the five. Randall's the only one that don't play no more.
Steffen crosses the plate. I say hi.
How goes it, man?
It goes.
You guys up? Okay, they scored three. Let's go, guys.
These are real old guys.
This is a 50 and over slow pitch softball league, a chance for a bunch of old friends to come out, swing for the fences, circle the bases, and rag on each other a little bit.
Dance around out there.
Everybody's sitting there, scarecrow.
But it is much more than that, too. It's a reminder of a bygone era.
I was there at 21 years at Kodak. I was like a supervisor, foreman.
I was an electronic technician. The last few years, I did circuit board design.
I was a supervisor of maintenance in the coding area.
Toolmaker. Machining parts, repair parts, build things.
All the guys on this team worked at Kodak. None of them do anymore.
21 years, I left. I left the company.
Went 24 years, left, because I was in the film area, and it was heading south.
I took an early separation, so I did retire 3 years ago.
10 years ago, they told me to go home, so am I going to be happy about that?
They had 27 downsizings in 24 years, and as a supervisor, I was doing a lot of dirty work.
It was a great company. It was tough to watch it go down.
American manufacturing, like happens in a great softball game, is being crafted as a comeback story in the 2016 presidential race. There's been a vow to uproot overseas factories and bring them home from one side.
Frankly, I'm disgusted with it.
A plan to spark a new manufacturing renaissance on the other.
Renaissance in manufacturing.
And threats to punish those who choose to take production elsewhere from both.
The money should come back.
In the 1960s, one in four Americans worked in manufacturing. Today, it is less than one in ten. But what does that mean in reality, and can those jobs be brought back? To find out, we went to Rochester, New York, a company town trying to rebrand itself as a town of companies, and a microcosm, perhaps, of America's ongoing battle with a shifting industrial landscape. This is the latest installment of our series with Frontline and PBS NewsHour. It's called How the Deck is Stacked.
Man, you guys got the pictures out already.
Joe Gogolski is the kind of guy that holds on to things.
I just started digging out some old memorabilia of our Kodak days.
He and Chuck Steffen have agreed to reminisce a bit with me, so we gather around Joe's dining room table. It's covered in old photos and newspaper clippings and trophies.
This here was back in 1982.
This is 82. This is the one you guys won, right?
Yeah, we won the world championship, 49 teams.
Joe disappears for a minute, and when he comes back, he's clutching fistfuls of coat hangers.
Oh, look at that. Those are nice jerseys.
Yeah, I mean, these are professional jerseys. I mean,
sure.
You know, I mean, you can see them. I mean, the company spared no expense.
Oh, totally.
Each one has Joe's name stitched on the back, and on the front, in looped felt curls, the name of his former employer.
I started in 1974. I was the first safety engineer the Kodak Apparatus Division hired.
Kodak softball teams were a big deal. They've got players in the National Softball Hall of Fame, and there are rumors they used to recruit new players by offering them jobs.
You know, when we were the Kodak Tappers, you know, because we were small, and we didn't have a lot of power. We were most single hitters and ran. And the teams that we played, man, they were big.
Kodak played in the Industrial League against other company teams from across the country. Steelworkers, auto workers, guys who made stuff.
We played softball. I mean, it was just unbelievable.
Yeah, no worries then.
They flew us all over the country to play ball, and they paid for everything. Cars, food, you know, entry fees. Every year we got brand new uniforms, brand new jackets. They even took the wives along on our trips, and they paid for all that.
It was great.
1982 wasn't just a banner year for Kodak's softball team. It was a banner year for the company. Kodak had a virtual monopoly on the film business. It was posting record profits. The company employed a quarter of the Rochester metro area and accounted for half of the area's economic activity.
Kodak was just fat, dumb, and happy. I mean, we just...
You couldn't beat it.
I mean, we had cafeterias.
Oh, yeah.
We had employee stores.
Ping pong tournaments. My aunt used to play on the golf league that traveled, bowling leagues traveled.
We used to have lunchtime movies in the auditorium. They would show one quarter of a movie on Monday, then they would show them, you know, the next quarter on Tuesday, the next quarter on Wednesday, then wrap it up on Thursday. And, you know, there would be 2,000 people sitting there watching a movie at lunchtime.
It was something else.
Was there a moment, was there a time, was there an instant where you knew that Kodak, the company that you had joined, was not going to be around for a while?
In the mid-80s, things started going south. I mean, we seen the handwriting on the wall. I mean, it got so bad. When you were writing with a pen, if you ran out of ink and you wanted another pen, you had to take the empty pen back to the stock vault. I mean, if you had tape, you had to take the empty tape roll dispenser back to the stock vault to get another roll of tape. I mean, that's how bad things were going. They were just cutting left and right.
clearly softball had to run out at some time, right? I mean, the company was going to get smart and say, no, this is just too expensive.
Probably around 1990, 91, everything just came to a halt. No more.
They just said, that's it, we're done.
Yeah. They just said, we don't have the money in our budgets like we used to, so we're not going to sponsor any teams. Then the Industrial League just, all the other businesses started doing the same thing, and everything just went to pot in the 90s. Just went right down the tube.
Most people know what happened to Kodak. The first blow was Fujifilm, a Japanese film company that undercut Kodak's prices. And then in the early 2000s, the company that invented the digital camera couldn't pivot fast enough to digital. It declared bankruptcy in 2012 and started tearing down buildings at its campus in Rochester.
My boss says to me, he goes, we need a safety engineer for the demo. So I drove all around to the demolition site, so I was right there when they started demolishing all the buildings.
What was going through your mind?
It's sad, all the memories, thinking, you see a building, you think, geez, I was in that building, we were slicing film in there. I mean, it was sad. It was actually sad.
When it really hit Rochester was when the buildings started to come down. And then you start to think, okay, well, what's going on here?
2 years after Kodak declared bankruptcy, Lovely Warren became the first female, the second African-American, and the youngest mayor in Rochester's history. Since back when she was a kid in the 1980s, Rochester has been struggling with a slow bleed of manufacturing, and not just from Kodak, but from Xerox and Bausch & Lomb as well, two other former Fortune 500 companies that started here. Warren says manufacturing was her own family's path to the middle class.
My mom's family moved here in the late 1960s, and they saw Rochester as a place where they could raise their family, where they could have generations that could have success. My mom received a GED. Her brothers and sisters, many of them received GEDs. They went to work in manufacturing.
Manufacturing changed the face of Rochester. Good-paying, low-skilled jobs drew in people from everywhere. In 1950, Rochester was 98% white. By 2010, it was 44% white, 42% black. And Mayor Warren says that when those manufacturing jobs started to dry up, a rift started to form.
Rochester is the epitome of the tale of two cities. You could live in Rochester all your life and never see poverty. And you can live in poverty all your life and never see wealth. And that is because in our community, poverty is concentrated. Many of the executives and the upper management that worked in Kodak and in these larger companies, they lived in the suburbs. The people that lived in the city were those individuals, most of them that worked on the line, that worked on the manufacturing floor. So when manufacturing left, and started to move overseas and in other places, the decline in the inner city and those families losing their income and having the struggle, and then the next generation under them not having anywhere or manufacturing floor to go into became sort of greater.
Mayor Warren says what complicates the issue even more is that inner city schools have suffered from the economic downturn the most, which has led to the lowest high school graduation rate in the state at around 50% and the highest crime rate in the nation for a city its size.
And so that's why you see this sort of dichotomy. You see this big, gap between those that have and those that have not, because there is no place for the have-nots to go and sort of build that pathway to prosperity. Nowadays, you cannot really go into manufacturing and get paid a living wage to take care of your families without some type of technical education. And what I hear from our manufacturers, especially our smaller manufacturers, that they cannot afford to pay someone that has $8 skills $15 or $20 an hour.
That is where we're going to go tomorrow. Part two from Rochester, the future of manufacturing in this city and in the rest of the American economy as well. Thing is, though, even at $15 an hour, it is still not going to be easy. Here's a sneak peek from tomorrow.
What are you going to do with $12 to $15 an hour? You cannot live on your own.
Until then, the story lives on online, a tour through Eastman Business Park and more. We've got it at our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
The fact that everybody now carries a camera and everybody thinks visually now so much more has, in fact, worked really well for us.
Another old company trying to keep up with the times. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 133 points today, 0.75%, 18,228. The NASDAQ up 48 points, 0.9%, 5305. The S&P 500 up 13.6%, 2159. There, cruise line operator Carnival sailed up 4% on solid third quarter results. Other travel stocks went along for the ride. Royal Caribbean progressed 4.75%. Southwest Airlines up 4.5% today. Tech was on a tear. Alphabet, a.k.a. Google, gained 1%. Microsoft firmed up 1.8% today. Twitter chirped up 1.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.55%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. On the economic indicator front, this item today, what is known in the trade as the Case-Shiller Home Price Index, came out this morning. Prices in 20 cities across the country up 5% in July, building on similar gains a month earlier. A slowly but mostly surely strengthening economy and the relatively small number of homes on the market are helping to push those prices up. Another interesting thing about urban housing specifically involves young people who are making very different living choices than their parents did. Marketplace's Mark Garrison takes a closer look at that.
You can see it in pop culture on shows like Girls, or you can look at companies like GE and McDonald's, which are shifting headquarters from suburban campuses to cities.
There clearly is increased preference for urban living among millennials.
Wharton School real estate professor Susan Wachter. More so than others, this generation wants to live close to work, take transit, and be near lots of restaurants, bars, and culture, features of the urban landscape.
That means right there that they're more likely to be renters in cities. Rentership is much higher in cities than in suburbs.
But survey research from the National Association of Realtors finds millennials may not be quite so attached to their downtown apartments in the long run, says chief economist Lawrence Yoon.
When it's time to settle down and own a home, what we are finding is that the vast majority of millennials are moving out to the suburbs. Perhaps it is more affordable, or perhaps they view it as a better place to raise their families.
There's a growing line of thinking that millennials will eventually become just as suburban as their parents. They're just not getting there quite as soon, possibly because they're marrying and having kids later than previous generations. Or this could be more lingering impact from the Great Recession and less of a major generational shift. Also, the suburbs are evolving, says Trulia chief economist Ralph McLaughlin.
Many suburbs today are starting to look like cities for all intents and purposes.
Suburbs with good transit to the city and denser mixed-use areas offer the prospect of the best of both worlds for younger buyers. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
We were talking up at the top of the program about Kodak, a company founded in 1888 that foundered on its inability to keep up with a 20th, never mind 21st century economy. Now, another company also founded in 1888 that is doing its darndest not to find itself in the same spot. The National Geographic Society is 128 years old this year, known best probably For its flagship publication, National Geographic magazine, Susan Goldberg is that magazine's editor-in-chief, only the 10th person to have that job, by the way, and she is today's guest on Conversations from the Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
All right, hang on. Before you get bogged down in that whole old stodgy print media is dying thing, I'm obliged to note here that Nat Geo is kind of killing it digitally and on social media. Sort of perfect, actually, for a magazine whose reputation was built on photojournalism. That is where Susan Goldberg and I started.
Well, visual storytelling is, you know, the strength of National Geographic. And so the fact that everybody now carries a camera and everybody thinks visually now so much more has, in fact, worked really well for us. But so have the core subject areas of the magazine. So we've always been about science and exploration and innovation and species preservation and the health of the planet. And I will tell you, millennials really care about those topics.
Oh, yeah, no, totally they do. Tell me, though, how you fit all of that into this media age where it's all about speed and all about if it's 5 minutes ago, it's old, when you guys have a history and a tradition of long form, plan it out months in advance, go to Africa or Antarctica or wherever, and bring back these really complicated stories.
There are very few stories that we need to break. I mean, we are not a news organization the way CNN or AP is. However, when some big event happens that's within our coverage area, so there's an avalanche on Mount Everest, we are going to cover those stories in real time because we're experts in those areas. But then what we'll do is step back and come back with a real National Geographic take on that with an in-depth story about how the avalanche on Everest absolutely has changed climbing and Sherpa culture.
This is a business, of course. A year and a half, 2 years ago or so, there was the deal with Fox and 21st Century Fox to make National Geographic Partners, in which 75-ish% of this magazine and the digital properties were entered into a partnership with Rupert Murdoch's group. Why did you do that?
It was a brilliant business decision, I think. What it allowed is the cleaving of National Geographic Society, which remains a nonprofit devoted to science, exploration, and education, and then this for-profit media group. So it was an expansion of our existing partnership with 21st Century Fox. We give 27% of all of our profits back to the National Geographic Society to help fund science, exploration, and education. And that is something that no other media group can claim. And for us, what we got was, you know, now we're part of a global, multifaceted media powerhouse, and it helps us get our information out there.
It's part of a multinational media group that a lot of people look at and go, wait, how does the National Geographic align with Rupert Murdoch and Fox?
Well, you know, 21st Century Fox has got a lot of businesses that operate under that umbrella. Fox isn't just Fox News, which I understand that is what a lot of people think of, but Fox is also the Wall Street Journal.
When this deal was done, and acknowledging that your boss, Gary Nell, is probably going to hear this, did you grit your teeth a little bit and say, okay, Gary?
No, actually, when Gary told me about this, I was really excited because, you know, it was hard to be both a media company and a nonprofit. And I think it's easier to be a for-profit media company that gets to contribute to a nonprofit.
What's the thing that keeps you up at night as you think about the media landscape?
What keeps me up is, you know, the evolution of the business model. We all understand how to make money in print, and the, you know, television channel, of course, makes a lot of money. But digital, we are all struggling with how do we make more money on digital? And that's true of everybody in the digital information space. It's a struggle.
When will you know that you've sort of crested the hill and you're good to go?
I never want to crest the hill. To me, journalism, and I've been doing this for 35 years, is all about doing better stories the next day and reaching more people the day after that and doing even better stories that reach even more people and a wider and more diverse audience. I don't see that you can ever say, ah, we're there. And if you do say, ah, we're there, I think you're not being ambitious enough.
Susan Goldberg, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Susan Goldberg is the editor-in-chief at National Geographic Magazine. You can hear the whole chat we had on our Corner Office podcast. This final note on the way out today because A, and honestly, Elon Musk is clickbait, but also B, the guy does have a track record. We had him on the show in his capacity as the founder and CEO of SpaceX about 5 years ago this summer, and I asked him at the time what was next for that company. Here you go.
I think that we should be focused on establishing a self-sustaining human civilization on Mars. I think that should be the central focus.
So, Mars. Today, sure enough, Musk holds a press conference, says if everything goes right, he's going to send a manned crew to Mars inside 10 years, and then in 40 to 100 years?
The Mars Colonial Fleet would depart en masse. Kind of like Battlestar Galactica. You've seen that thing. That's a good show. A bit like that.
You'd laugh, but you'd buy a Tesla from the guy, wouldn't you? We've got more on what was a typical, kind of rambling, classically Muskian announcement on our website. It's marketplace.org. Oh, look at the time. We got to go. Tommy Andres, Raghu Manavalan, and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kirwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Don't forget tomorrow, part two. From Rochester, New York, I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you back, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.